Hello, welcome to another Pharmacy and Practice podcast. We're in an actual pharmacy today with a good friend and colleague from England. Very pleased to have Mr. Ian Strachan with us. Ian, would you like to introduce yourself and describe some of the myriad of achievements in your career so far?
Oh, morning, Jonathan. down here in England, at least anyway, I guess I'm most associated with the National Pharmacy Association. I became its longest serving chairman between 2014 and 2018, and I was that chairman who presided over the government's cuts and efficiencies programme to community pharmacy back then. During that period, as you know, we achieved the biggest petition in healthcare history, around about 2.3 million. And we did wake up Parliament and the House of Commons across all parts of the bench in terms of its understanding of pharmacy. We briefed over 98% of MPs, and there was a real buzz and electricity about pharmacy. We partnered up with a well-known lobbying team of Linton Crosby and his associates down there in London, and we put pharmacy on the map. And we even challenged the government on its some of the impacts of its programme of cuts and transformation to the agenda with a judicial review, which we didn't quite get the result we wanted, but we came pretty close, and I think that's true to say. So a lot happened in that period. I was its leader. We were very much a united National Pharmacy Association, and I think we really did stimulate the imagination and the interests of contractors in pharmacy politics during that period.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Yeah, no, your career speaks for itself, Ian. I'm delighted to be speaking to you from one of your, I think we're in one of your pharmacies today, are we?
Yeah, we're in my berry shop today. It's my busiest pharmacy, and after driving you halfway around Bury in a car, we've managed to touch base here. So it's very busy. Yeah. I've got staff buzzing everywhere,
It all adds to it. No, so let's talk about pharmacy. Let's talk about community pharmacy. Okay. I love community pharmacy, and to be honest, it's really annoying because it can be very frustrating at times, the sector. And the root of the frustration for me, a lot of it is around the politics. So what's gone wrong with the politics? Because I asked this question when I look sort of south of Hadrian's Wall, I think, my goodness, what is going on? It don't take this the wrong way, and maybe some people will, but to be honest, I don't really care. It just looks like a mess. So what's going on, Ian? What's the crack? Who's in charge?
I think there's two things. One's an appeal to the members, the contractors, pharmacists, depending upon which body you're supporting at that time. But I do think we all really do need to examine the representatives who do represent us on these national boards. I think we need to understand what their purpose is, what their cause is, why they're doing it. And I've been saying that now since about 2016, when I got introduced to the top of pharmacy politics. I do think we need to vote for those people whose conviction, whose values, whose purpose in all of this is to truly represent those members with a passion and a conviction. That's the first thing I'd say. Second thing I'd say is that I think, looking back on it, at the end of my term as chairman, and that was in 2018, there was an influx of very much new people, personnel into pharmacy politics. We had a new CEO at PSNC. We had a new CEO at the MPA, and we had a new CEO, I think, round about that time at the RPS. So the main national trade association, negotiation bodies had a change. And I personally think that there was a change in style and approach. It was one where there was the accepted an agenda which was going to be more collaborative. We saw an approach which was perhaps going to be less adversarial than under my period. I'll defend my period. I think my approach, that strategy, was the right one. It certainly delivered results for us when I look back on it. But we did see a change. I personally feel that that change wasn't welcome and it was at the wrong time. And it wasn't in the light of the evidence which supported the achievements that we were making. So I think that was that was the second thing. I think that we also saw pharmacy in England being led by the executives of these organisations, the CEOs, and the CEOs then created a regular dialogue with the Department of Health and NHS England, and that very much, to some degree, had less reliance upon pharmacy representatives and pharmacy boards. I do think that went too far as an agenda, and these are my personal views. These are not necessarily the views of the MPA at all, but I'm speaking to you now as somebody who's a contractor and a member. So, and it's my personal views, but yes, I think there was a lot of change, and I don't think really the sector is still living with the change in that strategy.
And I mean, I ask you, who is in charge? Who has the most influence? Is it RPS? Is it PSNC? Is it the MPA? There just seems, and there's AIM as well now. There just seems to be so many organisations, Ian. And looking from as a casual observer who loves community pharmacy, it just dilutes it. And I'm going to give a big up to my chums at CPS here, you know, Community Pharmacy Scotland. Harry and Matt and the team, they've really done very well. And I'm not sure, I mean, there's obviously a lot of skill and hard work in what they've achieved over the years in stakeholder management terms. But as far as I can see, what they've done is they've sort of, you know, created a vision, which is the first thing that I think is lacking in England. They've sold it to their members. And they've agreed it, and then they've opened the dialogue with Scottish Government, and they've maintained that dialogue with both sides of the market, so contractors and government, and they've managed to move forward. They haven't gone too far towards everybody should be a prescriber and be an advanced practitioner and all that stuff, but neither have they said to the contractor base, actually, you know, you're not going to change. So I suppose. Well, I'm intrigued because I just see community pharmacy in England being doomed, to be honest. I can't see there's a question. Where's the vision? What sort of I'm reluctant to say three word catchphrase because that's a Johnsonism or a Cummingsism, but what is the three words slogan that sums up the strategy for community pharmacy in England?
Well, there isn't one, as you say. I mean, as I said to you at the beginning, you know, the approach in negotiation very much became across as reacting to NHS England's agenda and whatever plans it had. But there wasn't that vision piece. There wasn't really that strategy that we could take as a sector, as that spokesperson for the sector, take it to them, evidenced. We didn't move towards a professional agenda quick enough. That should have happened around about 2016. If that would have happened, we'd have had a suite of clinical services that were on the shelf, evidenced, evaluated, so that when NHS England came knocking on the door for our ideas, those would have been ready available. Mm-hmm. I took that agenda as far as I could during my period, and I was very much one about radical change, about almost liberating the potential of all these pharmacists by declaring them across a self-declaration of competence to prescribe. That would have taken away the barriers and the blocks from independent prescriber status and basically gone down a Canadian route with that kind of self-declaration of competence. I don't think it's something that got the unanimous approval of the bodies. I think they were too uncomfortable with it. I think there was a lot of elitism born into that. But I think that was really a barrier and a block to being able to really take pharmacy forward at scale and at pace, to be able to take it into this new world where it could have really taken the demand pressures off A&E and primary care. So in answer to your question, there isn't that vision. That strategy is not there. That was much needed. And I don't mean somebody else's strategy. I don't mean the Department of Health strategy, because I don't think it has one. I do think it has to be a strategy that's born out of the bodies, and it goes forward 100% resolved, and they put all these party political empire building agendas to one side, because that's a big part of the problem. They're all trying to build up their own direction and build up their own profile. And there has to be an element in all of this where, you know, there's an acceptance that we put the common good before individual agendas.
I couldn't agree more. I'm not privy to the private conversations, but yeah, that's what it looks like. There's resistance to change, you know, in certain organizations, well, across the board in various organizations, there's resistance to initiatives like fixed terms, which aren't a panacea in themselves, but you know, to have the same people hanging around for 20 odd years is doesn't really help anybody, does it?
And no, I think, actually, it becomes a bit of a club. The whole thing becomes a bit of a comfortable club, and people adopt positions which basically configure to personal agendas and deals, etc. And the whole thing becomes almost, you know, an institution in itself. Whereas if you can step back from that and put the interests of contractors and pharmacists in general first and foremost, base your decisions around what's in their interests, then it takes away an awful lot. And that's certainly the way I led the MPA. That was certainly the way the MPA was led from my point of view. It was never about individuals. It was about the common good of the sector.
I think I like how you mentioned Canada, actually. Incidentally, I personally had a conversation with the Canadian Pharmacists Association.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah, very. It was so momentous. I forget the lady's name who I was speaking to, but she was absolutely lovely, and she was telling me all about Canadian pharmacy and how community works there. But incidentally, off the back of an article we did recently around whether pharmacists should be able to make minor changes on prescriptions, we had a couple of letters from Canadian pharmacists, and I was interested to learn that they're already allowed to make changes to prescriptions, and not even going as far as, like, you know, diagnosing and prescribing and just common sense changes. I mean, these barriers are absolutely daft, you know. I would trust a pharmacist, community pharmacist, any day of the week to tweak a prescription or tweak a dosage form rather than the GP. The GPs don't have time to do that sort of thing. So what I see with another thing that I observe with community pharmacy in England is a lot of people doing a lot of things. And even at the highest strategic level, what I see is a lot of operational, what I see as sort of sticking plaster services. So, like, you know, the new consultation service, I mean, in and of itself, it's not a bad thing, but where does that fit into the overall strategy? Do pharmacists have enough control over that? I would argue not. Where's the strategy for prescribing? Again, prescribing isn't the be all and end all, but I do think it's a very important element of the future of community pharmacy practice. So how do we get the vision back? Because as far as I can see, there's not really any vision. And if you got your time again, what would your vision for community pharmacy be?
I think I'd have played it pretty much the way I played it. I think it was Karen Narutker, the chairman of the Canadian Pharmacy Association, who was probably talking to at that time.
It was, actually, yes.
Yeah, and that would be very much part of it, that more radical. I'd have I adopted a very radical approach to these problems and said, look, let's truly liberate the potential of these farms and not put barriers there. You know, how can it make sense to anyone to have a thousand pharmacists graduate from universities in England, get on a plane to Canada, operate at full scope without any additional qualifications other than 2 years on the register and working next door to a doctor's surgery, and then be able to do some distance learning course across a specific disease state and declare a competency to prescribe? Now, that was adequate, and that truly opened up the gateway to all the possibilities, whether it was amending prescriptions, whether it was carrying out vaccinations that were missed, so that the purpose of having the first vaccination wasn't wasted, you know, filling in minor ailments, completing a lot of the demand pressure off the system. And let's face it, primary care isn't designed for that kind of demand. Primary care will never reduce the bottlenecks on the system. It's only the network and its ubiquity and the distribution of pharmacies everywhere that is truly in a position to be able to do that. But the barriers are political, they're elitist, they're about leadership, they're about that passion and belief and conviction to fight for those members. And so it has to start with a collective vision for the sector. And it has to be one that is radical and doesn't put unfair obstacles in the way of being able to develop that and taking that forward. It has to move more from saying a trade offering to a professional offering, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. That was the advice I got off Linton Crosby many years ago. He said to me way back in 2016, he said, Ian, take the MPA from a trade association to a professional association. And he was absolutely right, because that was the direction of travel. That's where the incomes were, because there will be less reliance upon the state going forward. It's inevitable in society. People will have to take more accountability for their own health provision. So it's inevitable that the things that we enjoy at the moment for free will probably be challenged, and people will have to take more accountability if they want these additional resources and they want more services. So there will be more of a move towards private services. And I think it needs to be a very clinically focused professional offering, which retains supply at its heart, because we must retain supply. But these are the key value pieces. You could write a strategy for pharmacy on one side of A4, Jonathan. It's not a complicated thing. You know, we could develop the care plans that would enable us to equip all pharmacists in this country, in England, to be able to deliver to an operative level that improves the benefits to patients. All of that is possible. And you could write that strategy on one side of A4.
Mm-hmm. It's very, I mean, it's fascinating speaking to you. I want to address the free bit. I think we should lift the lid on that once and for all. So do you agree with what I'm about to say? So a lot of these free services.
Yeah.
So, you know, revenue through community pharmacy has not always been so tight. And when you and I both know, when the sun was shining and the hay was growing, and we were baling it, to take that analogy forward, there were a lot of people made a good bit of money. I think we need to recognise that, actually. And in that moment, it was about market share. Now, I know from talking to independents and multiples, we were all at it. And we offered things like free delivery service. We offered things like, compliance aids. And I find there was a story this morning actually coming out of Northern Ireland that the health and social care partnership over there are investing, I think it's 1,800 quid per contractor, to review their monitored dosage service patients. And the trouble is, when the sun was shining, everyone was going after market share and lower margins. So let's say 2 minutes an item for a walk-in versus 4 to 5 minutes an item for an MDS, right? So lower margin, but you'll grow your market share. And in the good times, that was fine. But obviously during a pandemic, that workload has been absolutely crippling. And I think the but personal view is the damage of those decisions back then was even more sort of insidious, because that extra bandwidth that is now required within pharmacy teams to deliver these things is actually the bandwidth that we should be, in my opinion, we should be developing new services just like you describe. So my question off the back of that big chat is, how do we backtrack out of this now that we're here, Ian?
Well, I think, here's a general statement, and this is a political view, but I think the public going forward, the next 10 years, it's inevitable that they will have to take more accountability for their own health and well-being. That's inevitable. So people will, to some degree or other, be penalised or be disenfranchised from not collectively as a group taking more responsibility for their own welfare. I think that's right, personally. As far as free services go, this is not a sector that can rely on a superannuated pension. When the NHS was formed, doctors were given index-linked pensions at the end of their term, whichever that would be. Pharmacy never had that benefit. So I guess goodwill and the day you sell that business becomes the day when your pension arrives. Now, right now, it is still incentivized, both procurement and goodwill, by volume. Volume enables you to have greater buying power, greater strength on procurement, and to be able to make better margin. For me, I think that's fair. There's various models being talked about, but none of them, I think, truly address the fact that there are complex issues you've got to bring together if you're going to sort that one out. I have a problem with the PSNC announcement around deliveries. I think we're living in a time now where we're seeing more attack on free home deliveries, particularly since COVID, from the large multiples, from Pharmacy to You, for example, from Echo, and other ones whereby they're almost discouraging people to use bricks and mortar. One of those value pieces is that you've got to believe in bricks and mortar. I believe in bricks and mortar. I believe in that face-to-face contact and that reassurance and advice and support that goes with a pharmacy at the end of your high street and next door to the bookies. If we're going to retain that, then there has to be an acknowledgement that it's worth to survive. And if we don't do those deliveries, and you're doing 6,000 items and you lose 30% because you start charging £1.50 a delivery, then those deliveries will quite frankly go somewhere else where they won't charge. Now, if that's the reality, you've taken your business from 6,000 items probably down to about 4,700, mm-hmm. 4,500. And that affects hugely the end value of that business, and it'll affect the profitability of that business. And this is where I find it's a bit naive in my view to even think that on that score. Yes, I think on MDS there is a sound reason for being able to take a charge, but even that will probably be met by somebody half a mile away. Now the argument would be, well, let the person do the delivery, or let the person do the MDS down the road and see them go out of business because the model's not going to support its viability. But no. Independents are a very resilient lot. They're very agile. They're able to respond to changes in the market and fluctuations very rapidly. And I'm afraid, for me, I understand pharmacies why they have to do these things. I think the real answer is for a political commitment to the network has been proven through COVID, a political commitment to bricks and mortar and to face to face, and then to formalise the contract, which means that pharmacies are not making losses and that pharmacies are supported so that network's there for longevity. And that's a personal view, and that's the way I see it, John.
Understand. I think it's a great answer. There's two issues, I think. So MDS, again, personal view, I think, and this is probably unpopular, but given the evidence or lack of evidence for the benefit of these Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday packs, I reckon contractors are on their own. Sorry. You know, if you think you can offer a free service and, you know, you're willing to invest extra staff time to get a bit more business, then that is a business decision. That's up to you. I think there's a, off the back of that, there's a fundamental conversation to be had around professionalism. And if a service does no harm, but it also does no good, should we be doing it? Don't know. We'll be debating that till the end of time. You could argue that the rapid antibody tests and rapid COVID antigen test come under that same sort of umbrella argument. That's for another day. The other issue, which I think is even more interesting, is the delivery service. So again, as a sort of business person, there's an absolute strategic opportunity here. Like, you know, bricks and mortar, set aside the emotional side, because I know you're probably attached to it. I do believe in bricks and mortar as well. No, I do. But it's a strategic play. It's a failure. I'm sorry to say, they'll probably be unpopular again, but it's a failure on the negotiation side that we haven't managed to sell the benefits of a bricks and mortar network. Now, if we can't sell the benefits of the biggest supply chain insurance policy in the UK during a pandemic, we're in trouble. Because that is just in the same way that we buy car insurance, in the same way that we buy home insurance, community pharmacy. It's not a very sexy sale, but that is a very, very important event or factor. And the never event off the back of that is, what if the internet goes down? And that is not an unrealistic never event, you know. And I don't hear any narrative around community pharmacy being there during the pandemic. Again, there was the emotional bit. Oh, we manned the barricades. But there's a bit of that offset by the fact that you're manning the barricades, doing all your MDSs, which you signed up for free to get extra market share. So there's a bit of balance there. The insurance play is different. That is different. And that is the USP of community. Do you agree on that, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a move away from MDS. I mean, I think I'm seeing more care homes now actually insisting on original packs, which I think is a step in the right direction. And I've got no problem with that. I am sensing now as well that there is a pushback going to come, and I do think you're going to see more of it. I do think that accompanying it with Marsh Sheets is a better way forward. There is a lot of work with MDS, and I do think it's been oversold. But, you know, I do believe in building the possibilities around the network, Jonathan. And but I do think those offerings have got to be far more radical than they can be. But I just think that pharmacy does need a funding model that can work without all the caveats that have to go with it now, where you spend 60% of your time staring at a drug tariff or sending things back because you're making a net loss on them when you dispense them. It shouldn't be like that. If we have a commitment to this network, and I think that the day is coming, that's what leaders should be doing right now. They should be making that case for that network. You know, and it's not about internet or distance selling versus bricks and mortar. Even all pharmacies are potentially internet pharmacies. All bricks and mortar networks, contract, standard hour contracts, are potentially internet pharmacies. There's nothing to stop them doing it, you know. And but we do need to build better patient outcomes around that network, and that is possible. The pharmacists are capable of doing it. There's no question about that. The pharmacists are qualified now to do that. You know, for me, the only thing holding it back has been an element of elitism and the lack of leadership will to be able to move in the same direction.
A couple more questions and then we'll finish in. I'm enjoying the chat, I must say. In terms of public engagement, I've thought for a long time there's a need for, you know, to basically educate the public around what pharmacists, particularly community pharmacists, do. And a while ago, like you might have seen, I started a hashtag, what we do in pharmacy, and I haven't really done anything with it, but it sort of, it did go off for a short time, and it went around the news cycle, which these days lasts about 10 minutes. So how does community pharmacy begin to engage with the public? Because there's no doubt the public love us.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do.
And how do we engage with them, or how do we move that agenda forward? Because if you look at other industries, like any industry really, like the fast food, pharma, they all do very, very clever public engagement marketing.
Yeah,
seems to be a bit absent in pharmacy. So maybe I'm not seeing that.
Yeah, there's been more of it recently. I think the evidence coming through now, there was a survey done by the MPA not so long ago with a group called the CT Lobbying Group. Now, they did some extensive research on this, and some of the findings were not surprising, because they were along the lines of the findings we found in 2016 when we did them. But you're right, Jonathan, the patients love us, they trust us, they value us, they want to see us do more. Our rating was higher than the GPs during this crisis for all kinds of reasons. So I think the platform is there. That public engagement is there. I think that there is more we can do. But I think the more we offer, the more convenience we offer, the more accessibility to a range of services other than just supply and advice. And P medicines, the more we offer outside of that, then the more that allegiance, if you like, and that sexy term to this will grow. I mean, I'm a great believer that pharmacy could have been involved more in COVID testing. It certainly should have been. We've got the postcode data. We're seeing over 6 million people, in pharmacies in a week. We've got the credentials to be able to do that, and we could have collated that data so it could have been interrogated and identified more accurately than perhaps it's gone on now, and we could have done that in a real-time manner. I mean, I think the network was made for COVID testing, whether it be through antibodies or antigens. I'm not saying there wouldn't have been some health and safety issues, of course there would, but in terms of the prize, in terms of the confidence, in terms of that PR exercise, and I think it's just a shame that pharmacy wasn't given that chance up tonight. Mm-hmm. But I do think that you're right. I think as far as the public go, if we can mobilize the public to be more on our side, then I think that's the way forward, because at the end of the day, the public opinion is way more powerful than any civil servant or any politician.
Mm-hmm. I honestly think we'd be pushing an open door, to be quite honest with you. I don't think you would be met with. So this is a bit of a tongue-in-cheek question, Ian. So I started my little business from nothing really, and well done me, whoop-de-doo. But what I hear from my readers is, or a lot of them is, how can pharmacies not make money? I mean, you've got people coming in and out of the pharmacy every day. The average item value is what, £9-10, and you'll get 30-40% gross profit on that. You've got, in marketing terms, the local community pharmacy is the ultimate marketing funnel to sign people up to email or all sorts of things. So take the question in the spirit that it's intended. How can pharmacies not make money? And is the claims around funding cuts just a classic case of who made my cheese?
No. No, it's far more systemic than that, Jonathan.
Okay.
I'll tell you why, for a number of reasons. First of all, if you break down a typical pharmacy income, then probably 95% of that is NHS related. Mm-hmm. Since March, we've practically had a lockdown, not just on people and the homes, but we've had a lockdown on services. So there's been pretty much NHS and OTC. And typically that NHS in good times is no more than 5% of your turnover. So, you know, for a typical pharmacy, and bear in mind that there are fixed costs to opening a pharmacy, it gets nowhere near them, it doesn't even touch the sites. And then you look at your core income, which is your NHS, and that probably represents north of 90% of your income. You've probably got a mix there of generics, which probably account for about, and these are very broad figures, okay, after my years in pharmacy, they probably account for about 46% of your supplies in generics, okay? And if you could make 50%, 60%, 65% margin on that, it's on relatively small values. So if 50% of your income or just under is comprising generics, reimbursement, and you're working on margins, they are still relatively small. Okay, in 54% is predominantly on brands. Okay, the brands that are out there. Now, most manufacturers, at least 40 of them, have put in place wholesale arrangements whereby there are manufacturers' terms for discount. It's what's called a reduced wholesaler scheme. So that will be anything between 0%, 6%, 7%. Okay. So the discounts you're getting are anywhere between 0, say, and 6.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've got to remember that the drug tariff is discounting you across the board at 11%. So all of those reduced wholesale agreements which are in play mean that every time you use dispense a brand, you're probably making a loss on every single one. Okay?
Well,
and
okay.
that's forming about 54% of your income. So fundamentally and systemically, that contract is flawed, because the only way you can get around that, and it's not really getting around it, you're just going to reduce the scale of your losses. You can't keep them on the shelf. Now, that's not the way a pharmacy should operate. That's not fair to a pharmacy. It's not fair to a patient. It's not fair to the public. It's not fair to anyone. But we've got round it because of logistics, because of the logistics of running a pharmacy as such, that EPS has probably bought you about 24 hours or 48 hours of time. So the contract is systemically flawed. Okay, and the truth of it is, and it wasn't like that when I came into the pharmacy in 1986, you are making losses when you dispense NHS prescriptions.
So if the contract is flawed, it begs the question, why sign the contract?
Yeah. I was never a fan of the 5-year agreement. I didn't understand why we did. Anything that ignores inflation, you know, compounding inflation over 5 years at 12-13% doesn't make sense to me. You're looking at least a $300 million deficit. So it didn't make sense. There wasn't, for me, enough guarantees and assurances around CPI. I know that it was going to be made up, but the reality, and you've seen it in play, I do think that when we develop services, we need to develop them with pharmacists at the sharp end, front line, developing them, working with them, understanding them, because that's going to lead to better compliance. It's not that pharmacists are lazy and just want to live on prescriptions. They're not stupid. Pharmacists do understand what they're doing, and they do understand systems that are going to benefit patients, but they need to be involved in the derivation. It's not good enough just to throw these things at them. You've got to actually engage with them, model them around working in a pharmacy on a daily basis, ensure that they're deliverable, and ensure that they've got that buy-in from the sector. If you've got those things in play, Jonathan, you're more likely to get success.
It's really interesting speaking to you, Ian. It really is, and you're one of the few people that sort of just gets to the point of things, which is really quite refreshing, because you know, we've got to the point that the contract is basically not very good, so but we've signed it anyway, so that's great, isn't it? What could possibly go wrong, you know? I look to Scotland, and CPS have sold a really good vision of prescribing services and so on and so forth. And I agree with that. I'm a big fan. I don't think that my personal view, I haven't spoken to Harry about this, but my personal view on that is that I'll be interested to see if they could deliver, because there's a lot of investment required down the track in independent prescribing services to make them safe, I think. But they usually prove us wrong, so I will be delighted to keep my words on that. In terms of England, I think a much more interesting model, and I'm keen to hear your view on this, and then I'll shut up and let you get on with your pharmacy business there.
Making prescriptions to pricing bureau, that's what's next, mate.
Well, I think it's much more fundamental for pharmacy, because at the moment we're in this lose-lose situation, aren't we? Pharmacists don't have the time to do anything else but dispense, and the contract is forcing us to sort of run faster and faster and faster. We can't compete with online pharmacy really in that regard, in that space. So you need to add value. What do you think of rethinking and reimagining pharmaceutical care and deploying it in a very simple, straightforward way? I mean, I'm sort of hinting at my, it's a bit of a shameless plug by 10 years. And that's basically, very simple care plans deployed to patients as they pick up their medicines. It's not a lot of work. It's very, a slick interface and all the rest of it. But my assertion is that investment in that space would get tremendous returns in terms of adherence, patient acceptability, patient reported outcomes, all that stuff. Do you agree that's the right direction of travel?
Yeah, I think you're very shrewd there, Jonathan. You've picked up on something that I think COVID, and the way we looked after the shielded, it's a really good example how we put our arms around a group of people who were highly vulnerable, and we took ownership. The shutters were down on the doctors, as we know. It became more difficult to get a phone call, more difficult to access. And it really showed the possibilities, I think, COVID. It showed the possibilities of pharmacy taking ownership of care plans, of a select group of patients, ensuring that the various parameters which could influence their health could be safeguarded. We could look after them, and through care plans, that would be a way of being able to deliver on that. And I certainly think there's an appetite in the sector. I haven't spoken about this, but I certainly think there's an appetite in the sector for pharmacists to engage in that way with these select groups, and let's champion away at them, prove our worth, prove what we can do. But as usual, there needs to be, from the core contract, some headroom that gives all these things the possibility. Right now, there is absolutely no headroom. And it is, as you say, it's a toil of almost daily, weekly, monthly, meeting the demands, reducing your debt carryover, which pretty much most pharmacies, I'd say, have got some degree of, and they can see it creeping up. So that fundamentals of the contract need to be addressed. It needs more money, but that needs to be the commitment from this government to this sector to say, look, we want to get behind you. We're going to show what you can do. We're going to give you that opportunity. Let's create that strategy, as you say, and those care plans could be very much part of it, Jonathan, yeah.
And I'm very realistic, and I don't think it'll be a panacea, this type of approach, and there are others doing it, but it lets us enter a world where we can start to deliver tangible value. I mean, sure, there's great human value. I mean, imagine someone was on a DOAC and we, 6 months down the line, they're sitting watching the TV and they think, oh, there's been no sort of physiological benefit to them. They think, oh, do I really need this? And they stop taking it. 2 months later, they have a stroke. So, prevention of stroke, for example, is a really measurable outcome. The costs of an AF-related stroke are very well known. And we could begin to prove as community pharmacists that actually deploying this simple advice that we've been doing since 1990, first coined by Hepler and Strand, we could prevent strokes. Asthma exacerbations, that's the other thing. I think there's a real popular need to champion what it means to be a pharmacist. There's been an awful lot of sort of and I've been bad for fueling this over the years, but there's been a real drive to promote prescribing. I think prescribing is important, and I am a prescriber, but I don't think it's the panacea. I don't think it's the be all and end all. I do think within the profession, outside the profession, we need a public campaign, but within the profession, we need to get back to promoting the pride and professionalism of being a pharmacist. And I just wonder, is that the way to do it? But
Well, what you've said there is quite important. And as you say, it's not even about prescribing. It's about the behavioural context. What pharmacists are very good at is shifting patient behaviours, because they're trusted. When you're trusted, when you're respected, when you're valued by people, your communities and society like we are, then you're very powerful at being able to change patient behaviours. And that doesn't always mean it has to be a pharmacist. It has to be somebody who's in connection and has that trust and confidence. And that's not just about the pharmacist, it's about the pharmacy team. Now, you know, you alluded then to stroke prevention. Pharmacists could be hugely influential at mitigating some of the risks of stroke. And they would be very effective at doing it. They'd be very accessible because we're ubiquitous. We're pretty much in areas of communities, population densities, pharmacists fit with that. So, you know, what you're saying really is that there's a role for pharmacists across that behavioural context, and I'm very much behind that. I saw it with smoking cessation. I don't think there was a single sector as effective as pharmacy at being able to reduce, increase quits, you know, and reduce smoking on the high street. It became huge. And I think that if we use that behavioural context of pharmacy much more and see pharmacy as a prevention, see, I know it's a big thing for Matt Hancock, he's always talking about it, now's the time to put the money there. But, you know, pharmacists could be hugely influential. Other people want that market, but why shouldn't it be pharmacies? Pharmacists can do it.
Absolutely.
And they've got the evidence to prove they can do it. So absolutely, Jonathan, 100% behind you.
I don't think I've met anybody recently that loves community pharmacy more than you, Ian. I think we're going to get on very well in the future. And as I said before the call, I'm going to come to England. I'm going to find you, and we'll go for a cup of coffee.
Go for a pint.
A pint.
Well, right. Timothy Taylor Landlords, a beautiful pint you can get down here. It's
very good. Everything in moderation, of course. Listen, you have been incredibly generous with your time today. I enjoyed the run in the car. Thanks very much. Let's keep in touch. And thank you for sharing your views. I think they're all just, any frustration that we both feel is just just because we care about the sector and stuff, don't we? And we want it to be better and probably just see an opportunity, really.
Yeah.